Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt. Today, we're embarking on, well, a pretty critical mission. We're aiming to synthesize some of the major forces shaping things right now. And we're using the contents of The Wall Street Journal for Monday, October 20th, 2025, as our guide, our roadmap, if you will.
And I'm Sam Aster. It's good to be here. Alex, this particular deep dive, it feels defined by uncertainty, doesn't it? We're looking at a whole range of sources here, high-stakes corporate deals, political deadlines that are, frankly, hurting real people, major international flashpoints, and, you know, some surprising cultural trends that show how we're trying to cope, or maybe not coping so well, with all this rapid change, technological, financial, you name it. Our job, really, is to pull out those key nuggets of insight for you, the listener, to help navigate this landscape.
Absolutely. Let's dive right in. And we really have to start with the global markets, don't we? This kicks off our first section, corporate maneuvers and these, well, significant shifts in investor sentiment. Before we get into the really aggressive stuff, let me just quickly set the scene, the market snapshot from last week's close.
Sure. So last week ended reasonably positive on the surface. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, it finished up 1.56%. The NASDAQ, you know, buoyed by tech enthusiasm mostly, climbed a bit more, 2.1%. But, and this is the key thing, caution was definitely still in the air. You saw it in the 10-year Treasury yield, sitting at 4.0006%.
Just over that 4% mark.
Exactly. Oil was hanging around $57.54 a barrel, the euro at 1.1655, and the yen at 150.63. So yeah, a decent week numbers-wise, but underneath, a lot of anxiety. Massive underlying anxiety, really.
And that anxiety seems to be fueling some pretty aggressive moves. We've got a classic activist investor situation here.
We do. A really interesting one involving Cooper Companies, the medical device maker. The activist is Jana Partners. They've been quietly building a significant stake, and now they're pushing hard for a major shakeup. They want CooperCo's contact lens unit, Cooper Vision.
Right, the big contact lens business.
To merge with its main competitor, Bausch plus Lomb.
Okay, so let's unpack Gina's argument here. What's their core complaint about Cooper's current setup? Because Cooper has these two big distinct businesses, right? Cooper Vision for eyes and Cooper Surgical for women's health and fertility.
That's the heart of it. Jana's saying these two units are totally unrelated. There are no real synergies, no benefit from them being under the same roof. And because of that lack of connection, they argue, shareholder value is being held back, suppressed even.
So the idea is the whole is less than the sum of its parts.
Precisely. For a company with a market cap around, what, $14 billion, and its stock price already down over 20% this year, that argument starts to bite. John is basically saying, stop trying to be two okay-ish things stuck together. Spin them off or sell them off. Create two stronger, focused companies. The surgical unit is actually doing well. It's profitable. But the vision unit, Jana thinks it could be way more powerful combined with a similar company.
And the target of this potential merger, Bausch plus Lomb, they're actually open to it. Their CEO, Brent Saunders.
He seems quite receptive. Yes, he's publicly supported the general idea. He sees it as a strategic opportunity. He's looking at the absolute giants in vision care, you know, Johnson & Johnson, Alcon. And he recognizes that scale is everything. Scale is how you compete on price, on distribution, on R&D.
So this merger would create a much stronger number three player globally.
Instantly. It would create a much more competitive third force in the global contact lens market. And that puts immense pressure back on CooperCo's board. They now have to prove that their current setup, this conglomerate structure, actually delivers more value than Jana's plan of splitting off surgical and merging vision. This isn't just about finance. It's potentially reshaping the entire global vision care industry.
That pressure to streamline, to shed assets that don't quite fit. It's not just in healthcare, is it? We're seeing something similar, maybe less hostile, in the luxury space with Kering.
Yeah, a parallel theme, definitely. Kering, the luxury giant, you know, owner of Gucci, Saint Laurent, they're in serious talks to sell off their beauty business. And the buyer looks likely to be L'Oreal. The division's valued at roughly $4 billion. It's a significant chunk.
But for Kering, this isn't about creating a stronger competitor, is it? It sounds more defensive.
It's absolutely defensive. It's about survival and getting back to basics, really. Their big engine brands, especially Gucci and also Saint Laurent to some extent, they've been struggling, particularly in key markets like China and the US. So this sale is about financial triage. It lets them focus their money and attention on reviving those core fashion houses. And critically, that $4 billion cash injection would make a real dent in their pretty substantial debt load around $11 billion.
Wow, $11 billion is serious debt. So it's a necessary move, maybe a painful one, to stabilize things after some rough patches.
It seems that way. A clear sign that even the biggest, most glamorous brands are having to make tough, defensive choices right now.
Which brings us nicely to the next major theme we're seeing, this quite dramatic shift towards the defensive stocks across the board among investors. What's the main driver here?
In a word, fear. Fear driven by growing global instability. We're seeing a definite uptick in the rhetoric around the US-China trade war, for instance. That immediately puts global supply chains and cyclical industries on edge. So investors, worried about a potential economic slowdown, maybe even a recession, they're pulling capital out of those cyclical stocks, the ones that do well when the economy's booming.
And putting it where? Into the safer bets.
Exactly, into the defensive sectors, the ones people rely on regardless.
So we're talking healthcare, consumer staples, utilities,
Yeah.
the essentials.
Precisely. Massive inflows are going into healthcare, consumer staples, and utilities. The thinking is simple. Their profits are generally reliable. People still need medicine, toothpaste, electricity, whether GDP is growing or shrinking. It's interesting, though, even within those, there are nuances. Consumer staples and utilities are often seen as the safest because demand is just non-negotiable. Healthcare, while defensive, can still carry some regulatory risk, you know.
Right, but overall, it's a flight to safety, and that also includes the traditional safe havens, bonds and gold.
Huge flows into bonds and especially into gold. Gold's performance has been really remarkable.
Which brings us right to it. The journal calls this gold's third major breakout in the last 50 years or so.
Yeah.
Just how big is this rally?
Its scale is, well, it's astounding. Gold's price has effectively doubled in just the last 2 years. Doubled. It now makes up something like 6% of all global investable assets. That's a share we haven't seen since the absolute peak of the gold frenzy back in 1986.
Wow. So why? Why now? What's driving this? Is it just one thing?
No, it's really two distinct drivers kind of layered on top of each other. There's the long-term sort of structural case, and then there's more recent short-term speculation.
Okay, let's start with the long-term one. The journal calls it the debasement trade. Can you explain what that actually means?
Sure. The debasement trade is basically a bet against the US dollar. It's the belief that the dollar is slowly losing its unique status as the world's ultimate safe asset, and so its fundamental value is eroding or being debased. This fear really gained traction after the US and its allies took that unprecedented step of freezing Russia's foreign currency reserves after the invasion of Ukraine.
Ah, so that sent a signal.
A huge signal. It told central banks all over the world, especially big holders of dollars like China, India, other emerging economies, that holding US dollars in treasuries isn't risk-free. It carries political risk. Those assets could potentially be weaponized. So these countries, and also big sophisticated investors, they're looking for alternatives. They're seeking assets that aren't tied to one country's political decisions. And gold is seen as that ultimate insurance. Insurance against the kind of political pressure they worry could eventually be put on the Federal Reserve, undermining its independence and the dollar's stability.
So it's a diversification away from perceived U.S. political risk, driving demand for gold from central banks and big money. But what about the recent sharp spike? That sounds more speculative.
That recent leg up, the really rapid acceleration, that seems largely speculative, yes. It was triggered by market interpretation of recent comments from Fed Chair Jerome Powell, what some called the Powell pivot. Powell shifted his tone slightly. He moved away from talking only about fighting inflation and started putting more emphasis on employment and economic growth as well.
And the market read that as rate cuts coming soon.
Exactly. It immediately fueled expectations of more aggressive Fed rate cuts in the near future. So speculators jumped in, betting that the Fed would prioritize stimulating growth over keeping inflation completely stamped down. And lower real interest rates historically tend to boost gold prices. It became a self-fulfilling rush.
We've seen these kinds of speculative gold bubbles before, haven't we? Back in the late 70s, early 80s, and again around 2011.
Absolutely. And those moments offer a really stark warning from history. The 1979-80 rally was driven by intense fear that the Fed under Arthur Burns had lost control, that inflation was going to run wild. Then Paul Volcker came in, hiked rates aggressively, crushed inflation, and the price of gold collapsed. It halved in about 2 years. Similarly, after the 2011 peak, gold spent the next 5 years basically going downwards.
So the big question now is this time genuinely different? Is that long-term debasement trade a real structural shift? Or is this mostly just another speculative bubble fueled by fear and easy money expectations?
That's the multi-trillion dollar question, isn't it? Especially when you look at the bond market. The bond market, which is usually seen as the more rational, less emotional indicator, it's actually pricing in lower inflation risk than the gold market seems to imply.
So the bond market isn't buying the high inflation narrative that would justify these gold prices.
It seems less convinced, yes. Which suggests that a large part of the current gold price might not be based on fundamental inflation fears, but more on that broader emotional anxiety about global instability, amplified by speculation. It raises that classic question: if gold is insurance, how much are you willing to overpay for that insurance policy? We might be seeing financial history repeat itself, that cycle of fear, hope, speculation, and potentially an eventual correction.
That pervasive anxiety, that search for insurance against instability, feels like a natural bridge to the political arena. Things feel pretty unstable there, too, with critical deadlines looming that affect everyday people.
Right.
Let's move into Section 2, the political battleground. And the big story here is this massive showdown over healthcare subsidies happening right in the middle of a government shutdown.
Yeah, the situation is incredibly tense, and the deadline is immediate. The enhanced subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, the ACA or Obamacare, they're set to expire right at the end of this year, December 31st. And this expiration directly impacts over 20 million Americans who rely on those subsidies to afford their health insurance. The timing couldn't be worse, really. It's scheduled to happen just before the open enrollment period for next year's plans begins on November 1st.
So people will be looking at potentially huge premium increases or maybe losing coverage altogether right as they need to sign up.
Exactly. And this looming crisis has become the main sticking point, the key leverage in the ongoing government shutdown, which the Journal says now in its third week. Democrats are basically saying, we won't pass any bill to fund the government and end the shutdown unless it includes an extension of these ACA subsidies. They're using the threat of millions losing coverage as their primary bargaining chip.
They probably feel they have the political upper hand there, given how many people are affected.
They likely do, especially considering the report notes that over three quarters of the people getting these subsidies live in states that voted for the current president.
Yeah.
So politically, it hits close to home for the administration. But the Republican resistance is just as dug in. They point to the enormous projected cost. The estimate is around $350 billion over the next 10 years. And they're not just saying no, they're demanding significant fundamental changes to the original Obamacare law as their price for any extension.
What kind of changes are they pushing for? Is it just about cutting costs?
Cost is a huge part of it, but their main target seems to be eliminating the so-called zero premium plans. These are plans, usually lower tier bronze plans, where the federal subsidy covers the entire monthly premium, so the enrollee pays nothing out of pocket each month. Currently, about 39% of all ACA enrollees are in these zero premium plans.
Wow, almost 40%. So eliminating those would force millions of low-income people to start paying a monthly premium.
Immediately. It would fundamentally change the affordability aspect of the ACA for a huge number of people. Republicans argue this is necessary to curb what they claim is fraud and over-enrollment and to make people have more skin in the game. Democrats, of course, see it as essentially a tax increase on the working poor and a betrayal of the ACA's promise. The sheer cost involved, plus this deep philosophical divide about the government's role in healthcare, makes this an incredibly difficult conflict to resolve, one of Washington's real sticking points.
This kind of high-stakes political maneuvering over something as basic as health coverage, it really echoes another story about hidden financial risk affecting ordinary Americans. I'm talking about this frightening situation with 401k plans, especially at smaller companies.
Yes. This story about Amanda Otter is genuinely alarming. It should be a wake-up call for anyone working at a smaller business or a startup. She spent three incredibly stressful years fighting to get back over $50,000. That was money missing from her 401k contributions deducted from her paychecks, plus the investment returns she lost out on. Her employer, a company called Information Technology Partners, or ITP, they took the money out of her pay, but they never actually transferred it into the retirement account itself.
They just kept it.
Effectively, yes. And then eventually the company just dissolved, basically disappearing along with her retirement savings.
That is just shocking. A total breach of trust. And it seems to expose a pretty big gap in the regulations.
It really does. It highlights a serious vulnerability in the oversight managed by the Department of Labor. The issue is that smaller retirement plans, The rule defines them as having fewer than 100 participants. They're generally exempt from the kind of thorough annual federal audits that larger companies have to go through. This exemption was meant to reduce the administrative burden on small businesses, which makes sense in theory. But in practice, it creates an environment where things can go wrong much more easily.
What kinds of things?
Yeah.
Just honest mistakes or something worse?
Both, really. It can lead to simple administrative errors, late deposits, confusion about paperwork. But in worst-case scenarios, like what happened at ITP, when a small company gets into financial trouble, that pool of employee retirement money sitting there before it gets deposited, it becomes a very tempting, though illegal, source of short-term cash flow.
So the company basically uses its employees' retirement funds as an unauthorized loan to try and stay afloat.
That's exactly the risk. When cash flow gets tight, delaying or devoting those 401k deposits can seem like an easy way to cover payroll or pay suppliers. And the scale of this isn't trivial. The Labor Department, over the last decade, has formally recovered about $24 million in missing funds through investigations. But even more telling, another $260 million was voluntarily returned by companies during that same period, often because they realized, perhaps through an internal check or an employee complaint, that they were late or had messed up the deposits.
So that $260 million suggests widespread confusion or delays, even if not outright theft in most cases.
It certainly points to a significant problem with compliance and timely deposits in these smaller plans. But for individuals like Amanda Otter, who faced years of uncertainty and emotional turmoil trying to get her money back after the company was already gone, the system offered very little proactive protection.
The implication for you, the listener, especially if you work at a smaller firm or a startup, seems pretty clear then. You can't just assume the money is going where it's supposed to.
Absolutely not. The whole appeal of a 401k is supposed to be set it and forget it saving. But this story shows if you're at a smaller company, you need to be actively vigilant. You need to check your statements regularly, verify that the amounts deducted from your paycheck are actually showing up as contributions in your retirement account and that they're showing up promptly. The cost of not paying attention, as Amanda Otter's case demonstrates, can be absolutely devastating.
That sense of vulnerability, of needing to be constantly vigilant, it connects, in a way, to the cultural anxieties driving some of our political battles right now.
Let's talk about the intense focus on transgender issues in the current election cycle. The Journal highlights how this has become a major theme. It really has. The culture war aspect, specifically around transgender participation in sports and access to bathrooms, has become a key strategic tool, particularly for Republicans. They seem to view it as a potent wedge issue, something that can mobilize their base and potentially peel off some voters from the other side. The sheer volume of advertising focused on this is staggering. The report mentions over 20,000 issue ads airing just this year on transgender themes, and almost all of them sponsored by GOP candidates or affiliated groups.
And we're seeing this play out in specific races, like the Virginia governor's race.
Yes, the article highlights the Virginia governor's race. The Republican candidate, Lieutenant Governor Winsome Earl Sears, has apparently made it a central issue in her campaign, even though she's currently trailing in the polls, according to the Journal. This follows a pattern. The Trump campaign reportedly found success with this strategy in 2024, dedicating a significant amount, some $37 million, specifically to ads focusing on transgender issues.
What's the evidence that this strategy actually works? Does it resonate beyond the Republican base?
Well, the polling data cited suggests it might be having an effect on broader public opinion. There's been a noticeable dip in support for transgender athletes competing in women's sports among both Democratic and independent voters since 2021. The decline is around 10 percentage points for both groups. The reporting also suggests that the issue resonates with some Black and Hispanic voters, segments the GOP is actively trying to court.
So for Democrats, the challenge is how to respond effectively. How do they navigate this without alienating either their progressive base or more moderate voters?
That seems to be the difficult balancing act. Democrats, traditionally strong advocates for LGBTQ plus rights, appear to be struggling to find a consistent, unified message on this specific set of issues. Often, the default position seems to be deferring to local school boards for decisions, or focusing mainly on ensuring safety and finding compromises, rather than taking a firm national stance on full inclusion in all cases. The Republican narrative aims to paint the Democratic position as extreme or out of touch with common sense concerns. It becomes another way to reinforce broader criticisms about handling the economy or other social issues. It really shows how deeply political conflict has woven itself into very personal aspects of identity and life.
That mention of conflict is a good transition. Let's shift our focus globally now into Section 3, geopolitical crises and the shape of new world orders. We have to start in the Middle East, where the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, brokered just 2 weeks ago by President Trump, is apparently under serious strain.
It looks incredibly fragile, yes. The report details a significant flare-up. Israel conducted dozens of airstrikes across Gaza, and maybe even more significantly, they halted the flow of humanitarian aid coming in. The stated reason for this major escalation was Israel's accusation that Hamas fighters had killed two Israeli soldiers. This allegedly happened in an area already controlled by Israel, using an anti-tank missile and gunfire.
And what was Hamas's reaction to that specific charge? Did they claim responsibility?
No, they denied it. Hamas's armed wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, put out a statement vehemently denying they mounted any attack. They claim they'd lost contact with their fighters in that southern area way back in March. The implication being, either the attack wasn't carried out by their organized forces, or perhaps it was rogue elements, or maybe Israel's account isn't accurate. But regardless of the facts on the ground, politically, the incident immediately led to calls from Israeli politicians across the board, demanding a strong response from Prime Minister Netanyahu. That forced an escalation.
The ceasefire deal also involved the phased return of hostages, specifically the bodies of hostages who had died. How is that part going?
That process seems to have stalled and become another point of leverage. So far, the bodies of 12 deceased hostages have been returned to Israel, but 16 remain in Gaza, according to the agreement terms. Israel is now reportedly delaying the release of those remaining 16 bodies, and they're using that delay as pressure, specifically by keeping the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt closed or restricted, which directly slows down the critical humanitarian aid desperately needed inside Gaza.
So it's an extremely volatile situation. The whole ceasefire could collapse based on interpretations of what happened in one incident. And it's directly impacting aid delivery.
Exactly. It's on a knife's edge. The stability of the entire agreement and potentially the region feels very precarious right now.
Okay, let's shift continents now to Latin America. A region also seeing significant political shifts and direct confrontations, particularly related to the U.S. and the drug war. We start with a major political change in Bolivia.
Yes, a really significant election result in Bolivia. After 2 decades of socialist rule, primarily under Evo Morales and his successors, the country has elected a centrist president, Rodrigo Paz. Paz won quite decisively, with 55% of the vote, and his victory signals an immediate and clear shift in Bolivia's foreign policy and economic strategy. He's explicitly pledged to move away from the country's previous close ties with China and Venezuela.
And move towards who?
Towards the United States. He's prioritizing strengthening ties with the U.S. and, crucially, he's actively seeking large-scale foreign investment.
Investment for what specifically? What's the target?
Lithium. Bolivia sits on the world's largest known and largely untapped lithium deposits. Paz sees developing these reserves quickly as absolutely vital, and he understands that attracting investment from Western companies, particularly U.S. and European firms, is key to making that happen and capitalizing on the global boom in electric vehicles. This political shift is potentially a major strategic gain for the U.S. in that global race for critical minerals, especially lithium.
That potential warming with Bolivia stands in stark contrast, though, to the deteriorating relationship between the U.S. and Colombia, which has traditionally been a very close ally.
Yes, the U.S.-Colombia relationship seems to be hitting rock bottom under Colombia's current president, Gustavo Petro. President Trump recently made headlines by announcing a significant cut in U.S. aid to Colombia. And he didn't mince words, publicly calling President Petro an illegal drug leader, citing the dramatic increase in coca cultivation happening under Petro's administration.
Wow. That's incredibly strong language between allies. Wasn't there also an incident involving Petro accusing the U.S. recently?
There was. This follows Petro's own very sharp accusation back in September. He publicly accused the United States of homicide after a U.S. airstrike, presumably targeting drug operations, resulted in the death of a Colombian fisherman named Alejandro Carranza. So you have these hostile accusations flying back and forth between the leaders of two countries that have historically been close partners in the drug war.
What was the ultimatum Trump gave Colombia?
Trump essentially said, very bluntly, that the U.S. would step in and close up the killing fields of drug production itself if Petro didn't take immediate action to curb coca cultivation. This is hugely significant because Colombia has received billions, over $14 billion over the years, in U.S. aid specifically to fight drug trafficking. This breakdown undermines decades of cooperation and adds another layer of instability to the region.
And speaking of the drug war's front lines, there was that incident with the drug-carrying submersible. The U.S. repatriated the survivors.
Yes. 2 survivors from a U.S. strike on one of those semi-submersible vessels often used for smuggling drugs. The U.S. transferred them back to Colombia and Ecuador quite quickly. The main reason seems to have been to avoid a really complicated and politically sensitive legal situation in the U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio had previously labeled alleged drug traffickers like these as terrorists. That raised concerns about whether these survivors might be detained indefinitely without standard legal process, maybe similar to post-9/11 detentions. Sending them back neatly sidesteps that whole thorny issue for the U.S.
How common are these strikes on submersibles?
They seem to be part of a more aggressive U.S. strategy. The Journal mentions this was one of six known attacks recently targeting these specialized vessels, resulting in at least 27 deaths overall.
While all this instability swirls around, Venezuela's leader, Nicolas Maduro, seems surprisingly secure despite ongoing U.S. pressure and talk of potential coups. How has he managed to stay in power? How has he coup-proofed his regime?
Maduro seems to have built a pretty effective system for maintaining control based on internal security and co-opting the military leadership. First, he's been ruthless in purging the military ranks. Any officers suspected of even potential disloyalty have been jailed or forced into exile. Purges have been ongoing, and Cuban intelligence reportedly plays an absolutely vital role here. They provide sophisticated monitoring and surveillance capabilities to keep a very close watch on the Venezuelan armed forces from the inside.
So surveillance and purges. But what about keeping the top brass loyal? Is it just fear?
Fear is part of it, but the financial incentive is probably even more critical. Maduro has deliberately tied the personal financial fortunes of his top military commanders directly to his own survival. Promotions are based purely on loyalty, not on competence or merit. And crucially, he allows, even encourages, the military leadership to enrich themselves. Through corrupt state contracts or involvement in illicit economies, including drug trafficking, they essentially become partners in the regime's criminal activities. This ensures their loyalty because if Maduro falls, their wealth, their power, and probably their freedom disappear immediately, too. They have too much to lose.
Okay, before we leave the global stage, we need to talk about China. The Journal uses this fascinating, somewhat academic term to describe its economic struggles. Involution. What does that mean?
The Mandarin term is Neiwan. It's become a popular buzzword in China to describe this feeling of intense but ultimately pointless competition. Involution basically means excessive, cutthroat competition that ends up destroying value rather than creating it. Think of everyone working harder and harder, competing more fiercely, but the overall pie doesn't grow or maybe even shrinks. Profits get squeezed to zero, it drives deflation, and it creates huge amounts of overcapacity factories making stuff nobody wants to buy at a profitable price.
That sounds incredibly stressful for the average person, the average worker.
It absolutely is. The article mentions how this intense pressure has led to dark humor about work schedules. The infamous 996 schedule, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week, has supposedly been replaced by the even more cynical joke of 007 midnight to midnight, 7 days a week. Workers feel like they're on a treadmill, running faster and faster just to stay in the same place or even fall behind. The effort feels meaningless because the competition is just too overwhelming.
And this internal Chinese problem, this Neiwan, it has major consequences for the rest of the world, doesn't it?
Huge global implications. Because Chinese companies can't make decent profits selling domestically due to this overcapacity and fierce competition, what do? They try to export their way out of the problem. They aggressively dump cheap goods onto the global market just to offload their excess inventory and keep factories running. This puts downward pressure on prices everywhere else. It's deflationary globally. And naturally, it leads to rising complaints and trade friction from other countries whose own industries are being undercut.
So other governments start putting up tariffs.
Exactly. Targeted tariffs and anti-dumping measures become more common. The Journal notes that the Trump administration, in particular, sees this as a key strategic vulnerability for China. They believe China's dependence on exports to manage its internal overcapacity problem gives the U.S. leverage in trade negotiations. Beijing is caught in a structural trap, and simply pushing for more technological innovation might actually make the overcapacity worse, not better.
Wow. That's a really complex picture. From global economics and geopolitics, let's make a pretty sharp turn now, looking inward. Section 4, cultural deep dives and the digital lifestyle. And we start with something quite profound, the way antidepressants are being reframed, almost as a lifestyle choice.
Yes, this is a fascinating and maybe slightly disturbing trend, sitting right at the intersection of mental health, the massive influence of social media, and straightforward commercial interests. Social media platforms, especially TikTok, seem to be the main engine driving this shift. The hashtag antidepressants, for example, has apparently racked up over 1.3 billion views on TikTok. billion with a B, you have influencers, sometimes very popular ones, actively talking about and, in some ways, normalizing or even glamorizing SSRIs, the common antidepressants like Lexapro, Zoloft, Prozac.
Glamorizing. How so? The article mentions hashtags like hashtag LexaproBaddies.
Exactly. It casts these medications not just as treatments for illness, but almost as accessories for navigating modern life, badges of self-care, or tools for optimizing your mood. It makes taking them seem cool, almost aspirational. And this narrative is being actively fueled and commercialized by the rise of telehealth companies. Companies like Hims and Hers are mentioned specifically. They often use paid sponsorships with these same influencers to promote their services, which make getting prescriptions incredibly easy.
How easy?
Often it's just filling out a short online questionnaire. You answer some questions about your mood and symptoms, and potentially days later, a prescription for a generic antidepressant arrives at your door. The whole process can sometimes involve very minimal interaction with a healthcare professional, and often little provision for ongoing monitoring or integration with therapy.
The article shares an anecdote about someone, Corinne Byerly, who saw these positive portrayals online, filled out a quick form, and got generic Lexapro delivered almost immediately.
Right. That ease of access bypasses a lot of the traditional checks and balances, the gatekeeping, that normally happens when prescribing these powerful medications. But here's the crucial disconnect. The gap between that often rosy, simplified online portrayal and the complex reality of taking these drugs. Many people who initially praise the drugs online or who are drawn in by the hype later experience significant side effects, things that are often glossed over or completely ignored in the influencer posts.
What kind of side effects?
Things like emotional numbness, feeling flat or disconnected, significant loss of libido, which can be very distressing, cognitive issues, sometimes described as brain fog. And then there's the difficulty many people face when they try to stop taking the medication. Withdrawal symptoms can be severe and prolonged, much more so than often acknowledged. This reality is often hidden beneath the surface of the cheerful online chatter.
And the effectiveness itself. The online narrative probably oversells that too.
It seems likely. The clinical data consistently suggests that while SSRIs can be life-changing for some people with severe depression or anxiety, the benefit for many others, particularly those with milder conditions, is often quite modest. Some studies cited suggest only around 15% of people with major depression get a substantial benefit beyond what you'd expect from a placebo effect alone. So you have this combination, incredibly easy access, powerful social media marketing that minimizes downsides, and potentially overstated benefits. It creates a situation where people might start these drugs easily, stay on them for a long time, perhaps unnecessarily, seeking a quick fix instead of engaging with other potentially necessary treatments like therapy.
It almost sounds like people are seeking a kind of pharmacological shield against the stresses of the world, maybe especially when even therapy itself can feel politicized sometimes.
That's a really interesting and I think quite perceptive point the reporting touches on. There's this idea that when the real world, including potentially the therapy relationship itself, feels too polarized or judgmental, people might look for something that feels unconditionally accepting or numbing. Whether that's the seemingly non-judgmental space of an online influencer community, or even the emotional blunting effect of the medication itself. This trend towards using medication as a buffer against the emotional friction of modern life. It could be seen as a symptom of our broader political and cultural anxieties becoming almost the main disorder people are trying to treat.
That's a sobering thought. Seeking neutrality in a pill when the world feels too charged. Okay, let's pivot dramatically now from the internal digital self to a very physical, very brazen crime, the Louvre heist in Paris.
Yes, quite a shift. This was a remarkably audacious robbery. It happened in broad daylight, around 9:30 on a Sunday morning, one of the world's most famous museums. Four thieves pulled off a plan that was, well, both surprisingly low-tech and incredibly bold. They actually used a portable furniture elevator, like the kind movers use to get up to the second floor from the outside. Then they used angle grinders, you know, power tools, to physically cut their way into the Galerie d'Apollon.
Angle grinders at the Louvre. That sounds incredibly noisy and crude. Speaks volumes about the security, perhaps?
It certainly raises questions. They were apparently in and out in under 7 minutes. They threatened the few guards who were present, reportedly with the angle grinders themselves, and they managed to steal 8 incredibly valuable royal jewels. The most significant piece taken was Empress Eugenie's famous diamond bow brooch, a huge, historically important piece. The whole thing feels like something out of a movie, very much in the tradition of spectacular French jewel heists.
But the article suggests it wasn't exactly a perfect crime. They made some mistakes.
Definitely not flawless. Apparently, they failed to properly set their getaway truck on fire afterwards, which is often done to destroy evidence. And, quite remarkably, in their haste, they actually dropped the crown that belonged to Empress Eugenie. It was found later, damaged. Though, thankfully, the most famous gem associated with it, the massive Regent Diamond, was apparently untouched or wasn't targeted.
So what's the thinking on motive? Were they after specific pieces or just the diamonds?
Investigators seem to be considering two main possibilities. Either they were working for a specific, very wealthy private collector who wanted those particular historical pieces intact, that's the Thomas Crown Affair scenario, or, perhaps more likely and more chilling, they targeted specific jewels that could be quickly broken down. The diamonds and other gems removed from their settings, the gold melted down, all to be resold separately and untraceably on the black market. Just raw materials.
Okay, back from stolen jewels to the digital world again. We're seeing this interesting cultural split. On one hand, a real nostalgia for the year 2000, Y2K style. And on the other hand, this huge rush into hyper-personalized realities created by generative AI.
It's a fascinating paradox, isn't it? The Y2K revival is definitely a big trend, especially among younger professionals. You see people consciously adopting the styles of the early 2000s. The boxy Abercrombie t-shirts, the cargo pants, even things like wired headphones and those old-school Nalgene water bottles. The appeal seems to be rooted in a perception of that era as simpler. A time before smartphones took over completely, before constant social media, before everything felt tracked and optimized by algorithms. It's almost an aesthetic protest against today's hyper-connectedness.
But at the very same time, contradicting that nostalgia for simplicity, we have this massive embrace of arguably the ultimate technological complication. Generative AI video, specifically OpenAI Sora app.
Exactly. Sora seems to be the perfect vehicle for creating what the article calls the AI narcissus phenomenon. It's about generating personalized unreality. The app apparently hit 1 million downloads even faster than ChatGPT did, which is saying something. The core appeal seems to be this cameo feature where users can easily insert their own image or likeness into almost any scenario the AI generates from text prompts. So you can instantly see yourself riding a dinosaur, exploring an alien planet, starring in your own action movie sequence.
Creating completely fictional but visually convincing personal memories.
Precisely. It allows users to generate this endless stream of highly personalized, visually spectacular, but entirely fictional experiences where they are the hero, the star. And this feeds directly into that paradox of isolation the article talks about. The user gets drawn deeper and deeper into their device, watching their digital self have all these amazing thrills, spills, and chills, as the journal puts it. The potential danger is that this perfectly curated, consequence-free digital existence starts to feel more real or more appealing than the messy, unpredictable, sometimes boring or difficult real world, and real human interactions become less necessary or desirable. It's the ultimate technological escape hatch from reality.
That idea of escaping risk in the digital world while physical risks seem to be rising. That's a perfect segue into our final set of topics and takeaways. Let's start with a very tangible, escalating physical risk, the anti-drone arms race.
Yes, this is a rapidly evolving field driven by sheer necessity. We're seeing startups and defense companies globally racing to develop effective counter-drone systems that are also cheap and reliable. The threat isn't just theoretical anymore. Hostile or unauthorized drones aren't just a problem on battlefields like Ukraine. They're increasingly showing up over civilian airports, disrupting flights, menacing shipping lanes, buzzing critical infrastructure. So the demand for solutions is urgent and the approaches are varied. We're seeing systems based on lasers, specialized nets fired to entangle drones, kinetic interceptors, basically small drones designed to ram other drones out of the sky, and sophisticated electronic jammers.
And the conflict in Ukraine has been a major catalyst for this innovation, learning lessons in real time.
Absolutely. Ukraine has become a brutal, real-world laboratory for drone warfare and counter-drone tactics. NATO countries are watching closely and adapting. The U.S. has initiatives like Project Flytrap, specifically designed to rapidly test and field layered defenses based on lessons learned in Ukraine. The key challenge is always the cost-exchange ratio. An attack drone might cost only a few $1,000s or even a few hundred. Your countermeasure needs to be comparably cheap or ideally cheaper and deployable at scale. We're seeing some innovative solutions emerge, like these small, highly maneuverable interceptor projectiles costing around $5,000 each. And advanced laser systems are getting better, with some claiming they can track and disable up to 20 drones per minute. It's a constant high-speed cycle of measure and countermeasure.
Okay, moving from high-tech defense to some interesting cultural snapshots that tell us something about urban life and tradition. First, this idea of an Upper East Side revival in New York City.
Yeah, it's an interesting shift in perception. The Upper East Side of Manhattan, traditionally seen as perhaps a bit staid, maybe older, very wealthy, it's apparently getting a new lease on life. The Journal reports it's increasingly being called the new downtown, attracting younger residents, new shops, more vibrant restaurants. The analysis points to two main factors driving this. One is relative affordability, while still expensive, it's become more accessible compared to the absolutely astronomical prices in prime downtown areas like Soho or the West Village. The second factor is improved transportation access, specifically the long-awaited completion and operation of the Second Avenue subway line, the Q train extension.
And maybe also a desire for a different kind of neighborhood feel.
Yeah.
The article hints at a stronger sense of community.
That seems to be part of it too, a sense of place, routine, maybe running into the same neighbors regularly at the local market or coffee shop. That kind of social fabric can be harder to find in the more transient, super trendy downtown neighborhoods. People might be seeking that stability.
Speaking of tradition and community, we have to mention the Porridge World Championship. The Golden Spurtle.
Ah, yes. A wonderful, slightly eccentric tradition from Carbridge, Scotland. Competitors literally come from all over the world to compete for the coveted Golden Spurtle trophy, which is, of course, the traditional Scottish wooden stick used for stirring porridge. The rules are strict. You can only use three ingredients: pinhead oatmeal, water, and salt. That's it. The real challenge, apparently, lies in achieving the perfect consistency. Not too thick, not too thin, perfectly smooth, it's harder than it sounds, and the focus on ritual is intense.
Including the specific direction of stirring.
Indeed. The reigning champions apparently swear by the secret. You must always stir clockwise.
Why clockwise?
To keep the devil out, naturally. A perfect example of how we humans love to build ritual and meaning into even the simplest, most fundamental activities.
Absolutely. Okay, let's wrap up the news section with a couple of quick hits from the world of sports. First, an absolutely historic performance by Shohei Ohtani.
It's just incredible. Shohei Ohtani, the Dodgers' two-way superstar, delivered what many very experienced sports journalists are calling arguably the single greatest individual game performance in the history of baseball. This was in the crucial game that sent the Dodgers to the World Series. On the pitcher's mound. Six innings. Completely shutout baseball. 10 strikeouts. Dominant. Then at the plate, as a hitter, he hit three home runs. Three. With a combined estimated distance of over 1,300 feet, it was just a staggering display of talent on both sides of the ball, redefining what's possible for one player in one game.
An amazing individual achievement. And as a counterpoint, we have the collective chaos happening in SEC football.
Yeah.
The Southeastern Conference is apparently eating itself alive.
That's the phrase used, yeah. The SEC, traditionally the most dominant conference in American college football, is experiencing extreme parity this season. The schedule is described as an absolute bloodbath. Week after week, highly ranked teams are knocking each other off. LSU, Ole Miss, other traditional powers suffering surprising losses because the competition within the conference is just so fierce. At the start of the season, something like 10 of the top 25 ranked teams in the country were from the SEC. But navigating that brutal intra-conference schedule has proven almost impossible. As of the Journal's report, Texas A&M was the only team left undefeated within the conference. It highlights how the sheer strength and depth of the SEC is ironically making it harder for any single team to emerge unscathed for a national championship run. The schedule itself becomes the biggest obstacle.
Okay, Sam, we've covered a huge amount of ground here, from activist investors demanding change, to the political deadlock over healthcare, the global flight to gold, the rise of lifestyle antidepressants, brazen heists, AI escapism, drone wars. As you synthesize all of this, looking across all these stories from just one day's newspaper, what's the underlying thread? What's the central pathology, maybe, that connects them?
That's a great question. I think what really jumps out is this pervasive sense of deep-seated systemic distrust. Distrust in institutions, distrust in stability, maybe even distrust in reality itself sometimes. And flowing from that distrust is this desperate search for personal guarantees, for individual insurance policies, in a world that seems increasingly unable or unwilling to offer reliable collective ones. You see it everywhere. The financial risks feel hidden, maybe lurking in your own 401k if your employer is small or struggling. The political risks are suddenly very personal, affecting your health plan premiums because of a shutdown. The geopolitical risks drive people to hoard gold as an emotional hedge against global chaos. Even existential risks feel closer, embedded in technologies like AI that promise connection but might deliver isolation.
And you mentioned earlier the connection between political polarization and mental health.
Right. If we connect that political gridlock in Congress over the ACA and the intense culture war fights like the one over transgender issues to that trend of people seeking SSRIs as almost a lifestyle choice, you see this unified emotional crisis emerging. Polarization itself, the constant conflict and friction, it generates chronic stress. It can mimic the symptoms of anxiety or depression, that feeling of being constantly embattled, leading to social withdrawal, fragmentation, the feeling that simply disagreeing with someone has become harmful, that dissent feels like trauma.
So disagreement becomes harm.
Yes. And when the world feels that overwhelming, when every interaction seems potentially loaded with political or cultural landmines, maybe it's not surprising people look for buffers, whether that's retreating into a personalized digital world created by Sora or seeking the emotional numbing offered by a pill promoted by an influencer. The world is wrestling with these massive systemic risks. Financial, political, emotional, and individuals are scrambling to find their own personal life rafts, their own insurance policies against a perceived collapse.
So thinking about that search for insurance, what does this all mean for you, the listener, navigating this complex world? We've seen examples today of people trying very hard to legislate away or avoid relatively small, quantifiable risks, like homeowners fighting updated FEMA flood maps because they don't want to pay for flood insurance. Yet at the same time, as a society and as individuals, we seem to be embracing massive, unquantifiable, uncertain risks in other areas, like the speculative frenzy in gold, or the largely unknown long-term societal impacts of hyper-personalized AI, or the widespread adoption of powerful psychoactive medications based on social media trends rather than careful medical guidance.
Which leads us to a final, maybe provocative thought for you to consider as you go about your day. Given this landscape, what risks are you currently accepting in your own life, perhaps unconsciously, simply because the perceived insurance against that risk seems too costly or too difficult to obtain? Maybe that insurance is the financial cost of diversifying investments properly. Maybe it's the administrative hassle of checking your 401k statements diligently. Maybe it's the emotional effort required for that difficult conversation, whether it's in therapy or with someone you disagree with politically. Or maybe it's just the mental energy needed to critically evaluate the information flooding your feeds. The price of vigilance, the cost of that insurance, is often high in money, time, or emotional effort. But as so many of the stories in today's deep dive illustrate, the potential cost of complacency, of not paying that price, can ultimately be far, far higher. Catastrophic, even.
Something definitely worth reflecting on. On that note, thank you for joining us with this deep dive into the Monday, October 20th, 2025 edition of The Wall Street Journal. We'll see you next time.